It was almost like every other house on the street's been burgled apart from ours, so what's wrong with our jewellery? At that time, we had the highest reach of any mainland radio station in the UK. I just smiled and said, Kelvin, you don't want to know.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who've made a difference. John Evington.
I guess I was a fairly odd young chap because while my mates were playing football and doing the things young boys do, I'd be listening to the radio. I was a radio fanatic as far back as I can remember. I have fond memories of listening to Radio Luxembourg under the bedclothes, as everybody did.
And right now on 208 on a Friday night, it's 8:30.
The Big Six. Now, let me just see if I can name them. Kid Jensen, Mark Wesley, Tony Prince, Paul Burnett, Bob Stewart.
Good evening to you.
Dave Christian. Legendary broadcasters. And it just had a magical sound to it, you know, the signal coming and going as it did. And yeah, I was an addict. That got me hooked on radio, to a lesser degree, I guess, Radio 1, because that was a daytime affair and we were at school most of the time. But I did start my day with, originally, Tony Blackburn.
Welcome to the wonderful world of Radio 1.
Later, Noel Edmonds, and for me that was the golden era of Radio 1, with his kind of benchmark features like Flynn.
Right, hello.
Used to arrive in the milk loads every morning.
Morning, Britain. It's Friday the 7th of December. This is National 247. Radio 1, with ya! You gotta get up.
I remember that was my alarm call to get out of bed. Happy days.
Very good morning,
yeah, I remember, you know, at school, Tuesdays at 1 o'clock, everybody would be in the playground playing football, but I'd be listening to my little transistor radio, writing down the top 20 when Paul Burnett ran down the newly released chart.
Race to number two, that means we've got a brand new. What else could it be?
And then later that day, I'd be at home, doing my own kind of top 20 countdown. Very strange behaviour.
Did that distract from your schoolwork?
Academically, I did well, but I guess we're all interested and we do well at things we're interested in. I had this obsession with radio. I always wanted to work in radio. I'm beginning to see the careers teacher and it would be a case of, well, you know, there are all these options ahead of you. Banking, journalism, accountancy, you name it. None of those interested me. All I wanted to do was radio, but it was kind of unspoken because nobody works in radio. There weren't any radio stations back then apart from the Nationals. And when I once did mention that I had this ambition of working in radio, the careers teacher just laughed at me and kind of walked out of the room in disgust. But that almost gave me, it gave me some determination to kind of show everyone that I could do it. And I guess circumstances just fell right, although at the time it didn't seem that way. I went to study a degree down in Portsmouth, and during my time there, I met up with a chap who had a very low-power FM transmitter, and we started running a radio station for the students. And it was, a perfect community of interest radio station. It was aimed at the students. The students got involved. We did gigs. We did charity events. I remember we once even took on the Radio Victory darts team in one of the local pubs. And that was a great, great time for me until the powers that be at the Polytechnic invited me, encouraged me to leave on the basis that my studies weren't going particularly well because I was spending all my time messing around with the radio station. From there, it was back home, tail between my legs, no degree, no qualifications other than the O's and A levels. So what to do now? Well, always wanted to try and turn a negative into a positive. I put some tapes together and started sending out demos.
9 minutes now past the hour of 5 o'clock, 261, hit music for the Northwest. A great pleasure to say that. This, for you, is Piccadilly Radio.
Piccadilly had just launched in Manchester. That was my local station. Well, as local as any, I suppose, because I lived in the wilds of Cheshire and it wasn't officially in Piccadilly's area, but I could hear it loud and clear on the FM band. I suppose it was one of those moments of fate where my tape landed on the desk of Colin Walters on the very day that his overnight presenter went down with something horrible. He got me in for a chat. I didn't think the chat went particularly well. Got home and the phone rang and it was Colin Walters to say, listen, if I were to ask you to come in tonight to do a show, would you be able to do it? Of course, Colin, no problem at all. And lo and behold, I was on the air at 3 o'clock that night. It was the 24th of November, 1978, my first show. Oh, I remember arriving at the station. I couldn't get in, so I was stuck outside for half an hour. Mike Day was on the air at the time. I didn't really know what to expect. I thought there might be people running around doing bits and pieces, producers and researchers and goodness knows what, but there was literally Mike Day in the building, and that was it. And he was obviously busy doing his show. He was very welcoming and friendly, but he had no time to kind of hold my hand through the first show. So it was a case of, there's the record library, go and get your music, and I'll see you at 5 to the hour. What he didn't tell me was I had no needle time. And those listening old enough to remember will know all about needle time. We didn't have a great deal of it in those days. I think there were 8 hours a day allocated to Piccadilly, and those were all used up during the day. So we had, I think, one track per hour of needle time music through the night, and the rest of it was non-PPL, soundtrack, session tapes. So it was all a bit of a shambles, my first show, to be honest, because I literally went on the air expecting to play great music through the night, and that didn't quite happen, because we even had a live musician coming in, chap with a guitar called Paul, was it Paul Rafferty? No, he was the pianist. Heather Whittaker, Paul Rafferty. Howard Jones used to come in and play the piano in the middle of the night at Piccadilly back then. I came off the air that first morning feeling just fantastic. It was just great to be on the radio, on a proper radio station. And I walked out into Manchester in the early hours of that that morning, into the commuters, and I had this kind of feeling that everybody must have started the day listening to me on the radio. And it was, I'm sure they hadn't, but it was a great feeling. And I just wanted to be there forever. I didn't really have a plan. I kind of worked from day to day. Obviously, I was a freelance back then in the early days. After a few months, Colin got me in, said he thought things were going okay. Did I want to do more? Yes, I did. Well, how about a staff contract? Ooh, that sounds good. At the princely salary of £2,800 per annum, which, again, I didn't really think about it. It was enough to pay my accommodation and some food and the occasional drink. The rest of my time was spent in the radio station, just beavering away, trying to finesse my act, as it was.
This was a huge radio station. Give me an idea of the atmosphere there back then.
It was a fantastic place, right in the heart of Manchester in the Piazza. The people were great, and there were lots of people there. It was a big operation. I think there were 60 people working in that building. In the on-air side of things, we had legendary names like Roger Day and Phil Sayer, Phil Wood, Mike Day. And of course, these are the people I'd kind of been listening to from home for months prior to actually joining the station. So I was completely in awe of them all. But they were great because they were always very, very accommodating and very happy to share their experience and knowledge with we young whippersnappers. Yeah, it was just a great place to be, great place to learn. And in terms of the station's success, well, there was nothing to touch it. It was the biggest station outside London, and I mean, everybody listened to Piccadilly Radio back then.
Robert Palmer, currently at 26 on the Piccadilly Hit 30. Following the news, the requests are 11 centigrade, 52 Fahrenheit. That's the northwest temperature. The time's now exactly 9 o'clock.
Piccadilly. First, with news.
An elderly woman has been killed in a fire at her home in Liverpool.
Building? Crikey. Our 12-year-old plays some weird games on his PS4, which are set in these deserted shopping centres. And it was just like that. It was a deserted shopping centre. All the other units were empty, with the exception of Iraq Airways. Not a pleasant place. I mean, it didn't smell great going up to the top of the escalator. But once inside the radio part of the building, it was great. It was very well equipped. We had a couple of Neve custom desks in there, and there was a Tweed desk in the Comprod studio. We had things like control rooms, broadcast assistance areas where we could field the calls for the presenters, and there was a huge live studio in the middle of the building, Studio One, with a grand piano in it. And yeah, all these offices for departments like features and promotions and commercial production. But Piccadilly, alongside the pop and prattle that went out in the day, we did a weekly classical music programme, award-winning classical music programme. There was country, there was folk, there was soul, all manner of specialist programmes. And Sunday morning, it was a bit like a Radio 4 sequence. We had an hour's debate with Tom Tyrrell, typically topical, I seem to recall that was called. Square One with Richard Sinton. We had a religious programme. And then old Woody came on at 10 o'clock with his fantastic Phil Wood on Sunday show. Very different times.
When it's early in the morning, you're certain to find Piccadilly easy on your mind.
I'd love to have stayed at Piccadilly forever, but there was a sense that things weren't going to change, and I think Colin was never one to mince his words, and he said to me once, you know, the Phil Sayers, the Phil Woods, the Gary Davises aren't going anywhere. So if I were you, being an ambitious young presenter, I'd put some feelers out. There are lots of new stations coming on, so why don't you try Preston or Leeds or elsewhere? And I did. I put probably two or three feelers out, and I got a very good response from Centre Radio, which was the winning franchisee in Leicester that was due to go on air in September 1981, I think it was. And I joined Centre Radio to present a couple of weekend shows, but my official role there at launch was head of features. And it was a great move. Wonderful part of the country. I did have connections down there. My sister and her family lived in Leicestershire. And the station had some great characters working for it in the form of Timmy Mallett, who was the launch breakfast presenter.
I had a lot of requests in this week saying, please, Timmy, can we have the first request on Centre Radio? So I put them all in a hat and I've come out with the winner, and it's in fact a record for my big turn.
A chap called Mark Williams did the lunchtime show, Mark Hurrell, who went on to become a BBC station editor. Tony Blewett, Steve King, who until recently was with Bauer. So a good team of people. The station had a great feel about it, a sense of camaraderie, and I think you always get that with a station launch, you know, the team bonds together. But 6 weeks in, there was a sense that it wasn't going terribly well. There were furrowed brows in the management levels upstairs, and we all had this feeling that something was going to change, and sure enough, Timmy left the station 7 weeks in, and every cloud, as they say, I ended up presenting the breakfast show. And I took over from Timmy and had about 15 months very happy time on the breakfast show. The station won the hearts and minds of Leicestershire. One of the negatives of the setup at Centre Radio was the building. It was a grand old house at the top of New Wark called Granville House. The programming team were on the ground floor in this big office. The newsroom were in a separate big room on the ground floor. The sales team were one floor up in their own kind of domain. And the management was separate, I think, another floor up again. And so everything was compartmentalised and people didn't tend to mingle. So any issues tend to fester in that kind of environment. Ever since then, I've been lucky enough to work in open plan office environments where the sales team and the programming team coexist and merrily get on alongside each other. But there, you know, we closed the door on the programming office and got on with our creative mayhem in isolation. And so when the issues did arise, it was kind of, a big, big thing. And towards the end of the time, the unions became very involved, and it was the ABS and the NUJ involvement in that station that ultimately brought it to an end in 83. It's easy to say this now, but I could see the signs. It was not a Piccadilly. It was a happy place on one level, but it didn't have the success that Piccadilly had. And there were issues in all departments, and it just went from bad to worse. I, again, started to look around, and when the opportunity to join Signal Radio in Stoke came along, I didn't hesitate in leaving Centre. And it was sad to go. And even sadder a couple of months later when the station went off the air.
We will now be playing music for you for a short period of time. We hope to give ordinary radio programming output in the very near future.
And so it's farewell, Leicester, and off to the new Signal Radio in Stoke. What are you doing there?
I was lucky enough to be the launch breakfast presenter and head of music, so I was right there at the cutting edge, right at the coalface on day one.
From me, John Evington, a very good morning to you, and a warm welcome to this, our first day of broadcasting, Monday, September the 5th.
And, yeah, the euphoria of the launch, was followed very shortly by a reality check. The station didn't cut through the way people believed it would, and 9 months in, it was trading insolvently, and something had to change. So there was a management coup. The original PD moved on, and the new team, which I was lucky to be a part of, adopted the mindset that, look, if we're going to make a success of this, we've all got to pull together. If we don't do anything different, well, nothing's going to change. We've got to change. So we upped the game. We put a new jingle package on the air. We extended the broadcasting hours. We tweaked the music policy to be a little bit more upfront and a little bit more feel good, and put some really bold strap lines on the air. And we turned the corner, and 18 months, 2 years in, the station was doing really well. And a large part of that was Signal's very proactive approach to getting out there and engaging with the community. It was a difficult patch, really, because it straddled two counties, well, three if you include Shropshire. We were based in Staffordshire, but a large part of Cheshire was in Signal Land. And that was the phrase we used, Signal Land, to try and give the area an identity based around the radio station. So we adopted a very aggressive approach to outside broadcasting and engagement with the listener. You know, pretty much every week we were out there. We put a show on Sundays called The Pub of the Week, which was great fun. I think one of the, again, this might sound odd, but one of the problems in the early days was the power of the transmitter, the strength of the transmitter. We were the first station to be on the other side of the police band up on 104.3. And we had a really nice transmitter location high above Staffordshire. And it just went everywhere. There was no interference, you see. So you could hear it in North Wales, you could hear it in Manchester, you could hear it in Birmingham. So when we took calls, we'd be getting callers from all over the Midlands and the North West, which was great. But what it did was erode the station's localness. And when I took over the programming of the station, I put a ban on mentioning anybody from outside the area, because it kind of defeated the object. We were a local station, and we had to focus on the area we were there to serve. It was the OBs, really, that got us out into the locality, and, you know, meeting and greeting the people, endearing ourselves to them, involving with the programmes. And you could just sense the momentum building over time. And back then, the IBA, God bless them, used to do a quite a detailed research study. I think it was 18 months into a station's life, and it was an attitudinal survey, and they shared it with us, and that was a very, very encouraging piece of research, which showed that people were very close to the station. They felt that it was providing a valued service to the area. Some really interesting things came out. They didn't perceive commercials as being a negative, and I've never seen that before or since. They actually saw the commercials back then as a positive. Whether this was a deliberate thing or not, I don't know, but we did a big campaign with the Co-op, and the product buyers used to come on to voice their own commercials. Sounds like a nightmare, doesn't it? But you'd have the meat buyer coming on saying the best joints to buy this week are XYZ at these prices. So it was almost like added value from the radio station in the form of the commercial. It wasn't like people selling. They were more giving out useful local information and advice. The one aspect of the survey that didn't particularly thrill me was the recall on one presenter. That was myself. I came well down the pecking order in terms of recall. The big names were people like Mel Scholes, who did the lunchtime show, Lee Finan from Drive Time, and Digby Taylor, who did the morning show. They all scored very highly on recall. I didn't. Looking back, I guess that's because I didn't have a massive personality on the air. I was on the breakfast show, and my philosophy, my strategy on breakfast was always to take a back seat to the other elements of the show. It was about engaging with the listener, giving them local information, the main news stories of the day, the traffic and travel and the weather, a couple of nice songs and a bit of a smile. I didn't force myself on the listener, so I took solace in the fact that even though in the attitudinal survey I didn't score particularly well, what did matter was Jikra, and in the Chit Crowd, the breakfast show performed really, really well. In fact, the station as a whole did well. At that time, we had the highest reach of any mainland radio station in the UK.
Good morning, it's Wednesday the 6th of June, and this is Independent Radio for Staffordshire, Cheshire and Shropshire. 257 metres, 1170 kilohertz, medium wave.
I took the helm of programming around about 9 months into the station's life, from the original PD, Tony Hawkins, whose brainchild the station was, and It was a daunting experience, really, a step outside my comfort zone. But I was in really good hands. My MD was a chap called Barry Machin, who was MD of Signal throughout its early successes. And he was an accountant, and he was a local chap who had a very, very good feeling for what people wanted from radio. And he was a wonderful sounding board for me. And he was really good insofar as he would bring me down to earth. Whenever there was a risk of my head drifting into the clouds, he'd bring me back down to earth with a bump and remind me what it was that the people of Stoke-on-Trent and the surrounding area wanted from their radio station. It was a very close management team. There was Barry, who oversaw the thing, Glyn Owen in sales, and myself in programming. I'd put my programmer's hat on and spend the entire day looking after the broader programming side of the radio station. But back then, we had the IBA looking after us in more ways than one. And one of the many interesting aspects of my role was dealing with our regional officer, Sally Laverack, who was a lady I'd met a few times as breakfast presenter. And she used to put the fear of God in me. She'd turn up from the IBA's regional office in Birmingham, and she'd disappear into a closed office with Tony Hawkins, our original programme director, and give him a hard time. And he'd come out all red-faced. And, oh, dear, the IBA have been up giving me a hard time. So, of course, when I took the mantle, one of the things I wasn't looking forward to was my first meeting with Sally. But how wrong could I have been? She was a lovely lady. There were some interesting conversations. I remember once she came in and she said, everything's fine, the station's doing well, and we're very pleased with what you're doing in terms of the religious output and the classical programme and the soul show and all the community elements. But I do have to pick you up on one thing. Your mid-morning presenter, I heard him endorsing a jumble sale. Yeah. Well, he was encouraging people to go to this jumble sale, and it was a Brownies event. You're not really supposed to do that. You can mention it, but you're not supposed to encourage, because that's giving unfair prominence to a particular event. And I remember thinking, do you know what? The IBA are great, but this is a little bit too much. Jingles are a very important part of any station. The analogy I use is that of, you go to a nightclub and it's the decor of the nightclub that makes you feel comfortable or not. You know, if your feet stick to the carpet, if the lighting isn't right, you just don't feel comfortable in there. And with the radio station, jingles give it that feel, that identity. It's the fabric of the radio station, if you like. But they also do important things like branding the station and singability, I think, is a wonderful thing. And if you can get people at your outside broadcasts and events singing your station name, you've won the battle. So jingles fulfil a very important role. We originally launched with a package produced by Steve England's team at Alpha Sound in Manchester, and they were great. A couple of things did slightly puzzle me. We had the station theme performed by the Halle Orchestra. It was quite common in those days for stations to have classical themes, because this is, back in the day when we all did classical music programmes, etc. But the station jingles didn't truly represent the kind of music we were playing at the time. So when we went with our second package, we made them far more contemporary and more akin to the kind of music you'd hear on the radio station. And then I think the third or fourth package we took in-house and used local musicians, local singers, and recorded them in a local studio. Complete disaster. They were wonderful pieces of music and wonderful individual items, but when it came to the functionality of jingles, they didn't work. You know, there are certain things that the professionals in Dallas and now Seattle do with imaging and jingles that make them work. The whistles and bells, if you like, and the package we did in-house in Stoke back in the 1980s didn't quite work. So it was awful. I put them on the air and I'd be listening to the station thinking, these jingles just aren't working. And of course, it was my responsibility, and nobody else was going to say anything. So I went to Barry and said, look, we better pull these off. What are you going to do then? Well, how's about a trip to Dallas? Great. So then we went with Jam and had some really, really nice imaging from Jam, then Century 21. Happy days.
One, two...
Well, it was an interesting period insofar as, again, the IBA and the radio authority that took over used to organise an annual get-together of station programmers. And I'd be there representing Signal. And, you know, originally it was a case of 20 or 30 independent station programmers and professionals meeting up and exchanging thoughts and ideas. But gradually, as the consolidation started, there'd be the GWR posse and the EMAP posse all gathering together. And towards the end of that era, I'd find myself quite isolated because everybody else was part of a group. Signal was still truly independent. And it got to the point where Barry Glynn and myself would have conversations about this, and we were wondering why nobody had made the approach. It was almost like every other house on the street's been burgled apart from ours, so what's wrong with our jewellery? We highlighted this with the board and suggested that maybe the board might look at a disposal, because there were benefits, clear benefits, in terms of being part of a group. After years of independence, the day came and a lot of interest was expressed in Signal by the other groups, and we went through due diligence with GWR, with Transworld. Scottish Radio came and spoke to us. Enterprise down in South Wales. We were very popular. But we ended up being brought by a group called the Radio Partnership, which was the former Metro Radio Management. And what was nice was that we were part of a brand new group at its inception. The group, when it formed, comprised Signal, The Pulse and Swansea Sound. The guys from Metro were very experienced people. John Josephs, Maurice Dobson, Eric Lawrence and Giles actually wasn't involved at the time, but subsequently Giles Squire became involved. And just a fabulous team of people to work with. They were very keen to give us plenty of autonomy, plenty of room to do our own thing, because they understood that it was about local radio being managed and run by local people. And that was a really, really happy time for us. And the group grew, and we acquired some other stations. And what was nice was that we were able to become involved with those operations and roll out the successful formulae that had been used in Bradford, Swansea and Stoke to areas like Bolton, Bury, Chesterfield and Wolverhampton. And then, of course, another change in 1999 when the Wireless Group came knocking on the door. So I'd been at Signal for 16 years, which is a long innings. I remember when I joined Signal at its launch, I was, 24 years of age? And in my head, I'd done 3 years in Manchester, a couple of years in Leicester. I thought I'd be at Stoke for maybe 3 or 4 years, then move on to the next challenge. But 16 years on, I'm still there. And we hear a rumour that the ownership's about to change. Who's after us? Well, it's a company called the Wireless Group. Never heard of them. Who owns it? Who runs it? Who are the movers and shakers? Oh, it's the former senator, Kelvin McKenzie. Ah, I've seen Kelvin on telly. He's a bit of a fiery character, isn't he?
I want my universities just to take clever people. If they turn out to be rich, clever people, or the sons of rich, clever people, I don't care.
Yeah, but hold on, you're presuming.
And this is in the early days of the internet, of course. And we all went and Googled Kelvin McKenzie. And it made very interesting reading. And one of the things that caught my eye was Kelvin's attitude towards people who've been in the same role for more than 3 or 4 years. Not very impressed, he isn't, by anyone who stays in the same role for more than a couple of years. And, of course, subsequently, it came to light that it was indeed the Wireless Group. The deal went through and Kelvin came on a grand tour to meet the management teams at each of the radio stations. And I'll never forget that first meeting with Kelvin. He was fine. He was very interested in what we'd done over the years, and he keen to find out about the station and the area and the opportunities for his new group. And then the question I was hoping he wouldn't ask me, he asked me. So how long have you been here then? I just smiled and said, Kelvin, you don't want to know. Come on, how long? 16 years. and the air went blue. 16 years in Stoke-on-Trent, the graveyard of ambition. And he gave me a fair amount of grief over that. But what I said to Kelvin was, look, you do meet people in life who have literally had the same year's experience, 16, 17, 20, 30 years over. But for us here, it hasn't been that way. Every single year that's come along has been different. It's had new challenges, new opportunities. And I talked him through the chronology from the launch right through the splits, through things we did like Echo 96, which was the UK's first adult contemporary station. So many things we'd done over the years and succeeded at. Failures, of course, along the way as well. But Kelvin seemed impressed and we became part of the Wireless Group and the group grew. And I spent my final 4 years reporting directly into Kelvin as his group PD, which was it was interesting. It had its challenging moments, but what I got from Kelvin was it was a fun time, although there were moments when it wasn't fun. Over the first couple of years of the Wireless Group, I think I'm right in saying Kelvin got through 6 group programmers. It was a very unsettling period because each time there was a change, different philosophies came into play. We had a chap from Australia who was in charge for a while. He had his very, very strong ideas on which way the group should be going in terms of branding and, you know, homogenizing stations and formats across all sites in the group, which I have to say I didn't particularly subscribe to at the time. You know, people came and went at the top of the programming of the group. I'll never forget the day I was called down to London by Ashley McKenzie, who was the group MD. And he said, look, John, you know, you've done a great job at Signal. You've kind of kept your head down and got on with it through difficult times. We'd like you to consider taking on the group role. And that totally fazed me. And again, it kind of reminded me of my early days at Signal when I was called in and offered the opportunity to become PD. It was a massive step outside my comfort zone. But I went back to base and thought it through and discussed it with a couple of close colleagues. And the upshot was, actually, I have got a lot to offer here. And we've got some great stations in the group, some of which are flying, others need a bit of help and encouragement. So I saw that as being my role, to go in there and nurture talent, to share ideas that have worked around the group, and just try and bring things forward and develop the group in a fairly hands-off way.
We are the Pulse, playing all hits all day. It's day one. I'm Elliot Webb.
Radio was always interesting. People used to collar me at industry events. Oh, God, you poor bastard. What's it like with Kelvin and Rajar? I bet it's awful. Because you know what it's like, you know, when you across 17 brands and the Rajar comes in, you're going to get some good ones, you're going to get some okay ones, and you're going to get some really, really shocking results. So that was, and Kelvin would always insist on a call within 10 minutes of the book arriving. So, and he'd want the answers. What's happened? Why has it happened? And what are we going to do about it? But towards the end of the time, because we'd been through all the stuff with JFK and the people meters and the court case with Rajar and everything, towards the end, it was a breeze because Rajar had come in, usual thing, some good ones, some bad ones, some OKs. Hi, Kelvin. Right, come on, what's happened? Well, Signal's done well, Stoke's done okay, Pulse is down a tad, Swansea's performed brilliantly, and you don't want to know about the rest. Go on, tell me. Well, come on, Kelvin, it's radio. You know it's a load of bollocks, don't you? Yeah, you're right, matey. Bye. 102.6 FM, Signal 1. First week of July 2005, a number of things happened to me. On the Wednesday, which was the 4th of July, my divorce was finalised. And I remember that because we talked about it as Independence Day. On the 5th of July, I was informed that my services were no longer required by UTV, which was a shock on one level, but actually 22 years down the line, I'd had a very good innings and, you know, you take these things in your stride. But then the following day, I jumped in the car and decided to head to the Lake District to do a bit of thinking. because obviously after 22 years in gainful employment, it was time to think about the next move for me. And it was a lovely day, drove to the lakes, put a CD in place of the radio, which was very unlike me, switched my phone off, and had a very pleasant day, actually, walking around Buttermere and went for a pint and a toasty and did lots of thinking about the radio industry and what I quite fancied doing, if anything. And jumped back in the car, started to head home, and as I got closer to the M6, my phone burst into life, 22 missed calls. And, of course, it was 7-7. I'd left the wireless group, but nobody in the wireless group knew, and all the programmers had been phoning me for advice on what to do, because this major news story had broken and they didn't know what the hell to do. On one level, it was a case of, you know, feeling really disappointed that my programmers had been after me and I wasn't available for them. But on the other hand, it was, well, okay, UTV, you think you don't need a group PD? Perhaps you do.
So after that lengthy spell in Stoke, you're out. What happens next?
I decided to do a bit of travelling and combining travelling with work. And I got the opportunity to go over and do some consulting in the Emirates, which was great fun. And then I did a couple of months training and lecturing over in China in a place called Foshan. That was a truly enjoyable experience, but very enlightening. And it just reinforced my belief that people are the same wherever you go in the world. And radio as a medium has the same appeal wherever you go in the world. You know, I was talking to a room full of Chinese presenters through an interpreter in exactly the same way as I would to a team of UK presenters. And all the frustrations that we have in UK radio, they have over there. And I was quite surprised, actually, that one of their bugbears was the number of ads on the air, because this is, you know, this is communist China. And back then, the commercialism hadn't exploded the way it has now over there. And I was quite surprised that they had issues of sponsor tags and too many ads in the hour and commercial clutter. All the same issues applied over there. So yeah, really fond memories of my time in China. And then it was back to the UK, and I had a call from a company I'd never heard of, Canwest Media, asking if I'd like to talk to them about putting a new radio station on the air, adult contemporary format, for the Solent region. Well, as I say, I'd never heard of Canwest, so I did a bit of research, and it turned out that they were rather a large player, a multi-billion dollar operation based in Canada, and in their home territory. They were a bit like Sky and ITV roll into one. They'd got the number one website, Canada.com, and they had radio interests in New Zealand and Turkey and in various other places around the world. So it seemed like a fairly good company to go and join. I'd got no real ties in the north anymore, so I was young, well, free and single, and able to relocate and give the job 100%. It was, for me, the realisation of a really long-held ambition to take a completely empty selector database and build it from scratch. And that was quite a task, because I had to develop a category and clock structure which met with the strict top 30 quotas that were enshrined in the station's licence. But I did it and had some incredible fun in the process, hired a great team of presenters, and off we went, competing head-on with Wave 105, Ocean, Power, 2CR, and around 15 other stations scattered across the region.
Everyone's getting into it. The South's new radio station.
Well, it was received very well by the critics and the industry, but as you know, in this game, it's all about what the public wants. It was always going to be a battle getting a radio station established that couldn't play familiar music and had to run 50% speech through most of the day. So it was a toughie, and there are certain things even an open plan office can't remedy. But 7 months in, I was promoted to the MD's position, which gave me responsibility for all aspects of the station operation. The Canadian board were very supportive, and cash wasn't a problem. I got the finance I needed to bring in some big-name presenters like Tommy Boyd and Richard Skinner. We marketed the station heavily on outdoor and TV, bus sides, you name it. But something suddenly changed around the end of 2007. It was like a light switch being turned off. Suddenly, budgets weren't there. And, of course, what was happening was on a much bigger scale than our little station on the south coast. Canwest was in free fall, and subsequently, the company went into liquidation and is no more. Well, I was swiftly moved out, and shortly afterwards, the station was sold to Celador. But no regrets. It was a brilliant time in my career. And looking at what's happening down there now, it's good to see the station that is now Sam FM building a strong following. But it was always going to be a slow burn for original.
So another chapter over. What next?
I had a conversation with Steve Penk, who I had worked with many, many years previously at Piccadilly. And Steve, like me, had been through the mill, and he'd kind of fallen out of love with radio. He was newly out of Fox FM. I'd recently left Original, and we met up for a pint, and it was almost like a grumpy old men conversation about how wonderful things used to be. And so it was a case of, what can we do now? And I said to Steve, well, look, there is one option. Why don't you get your own radio station? Then you can do it your way. But how do we do that? Leave it with me. So I went and looked around and spoke to a number of people, and cutting a long story short, Steve ended up buying the Revolution in Oldham, which had been a very successful local radio station. When it was launched, it was truly local. It was a very visible station in Oldham and its other main towns, Rochdale and Tameside. It actually built an audience of 1 million hours. It was turning over £1 million. But there'd been a change. It had become a left-field indie rock station. It was co-owned by UKRD and the local newspaper, the Oldham Chronicle, and they were looking to dispose. Steve picked it up, and our blueprint for turning it round was fairly straightforward. Go back to mainstream music, go back to giving the people a truly local radio station, getting out and about, being seen around the towns, and, trump card, Steve Penk on breakfast, doing what Steve Penk does very, very well, which is a tight, slick breakfast show with that added ingredient of the wind-up phone calls.
Hello?
Hello, can I speak to Mrs. Lally, please?
Speaking.
Tony Taylor from the insurance company.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. I think Steve was expecting an immediate turnaround, but as we all know, it takes time to recover a brand. It's far easier to lose an audience than to win one back, as I always say. And it was a tough old battle, both on the audience and revenue front. The audience did start coming back, quite spectacularly, actually. Revenue was tougher. Steve couldn't have bought the station at a worse time. Hindsight is a wonderful thing, but the day Steve got the keys to the station was the day Lehman Brothers went into receivership and the recession started. So it wasn't a great time to be out there trying to convince local advertisers that they should spend their money on this this newly relaunched radio station. So it was a tough old battle, but a really, really great episode in my career. It was wonderful to get the old sleeves rolled up again and get back to the microphone and work with the team there to try and drive it forward.
It's one of the perils of this business, isn't it? So many different stations, so many jobs in different parts of the country, and upheaval for your family.
It is, but it's a great business, and I wouldn't swap it for anything. You know, I can't think of a time when I woke up in the morning and didn't want to go to work. There's just something about this business that energises me. I'm lucky in that I've had a lot of very different experience. I've worked at small stations, big stations. I've presented at national level on Radio 2. I've presented on the smallest of stations. But the job's the job. And, I mean, now I'm working with a speech format in Manchester, which, again, is probably the most enjoyable thing I've done. Literally starting with a clean sheet of paper, with today's technology, pushing the envelope, doing things that haven't been done before, giving things a go. If they work, fantastic. If they don't work, never mind, we'll tweak that and try it another way. We're on a digital platform in a big city, doing something very different. It's as rewarding as anything I've ever done.
As you look back at your 30/40 years in radio of often very different forms, are there any things you would have done differently?
No, I've got no regrets, I don't think. I've seized lots of opportunities along the way. There have been other opportunities that I looked at and didn't go for, but in hindsight, I think I probably made the right decision. 22 years at Signal, was that healthy? Possibly not, but as I said earlier, it wasn't a case of just doing the same thing over and over again. Just when things started to become mundane, there was a new opportunity, something new to try, something different. Towards the end of the time, there were the opportunities that emerged for the entire team at Signal being part of a group structure. And it was a long, long innings at Signal, but I enjoyed pretty much every moment of it. And since then, you know, people say to me, oh, original must have been a challenge. Well, yes, it was, but it was a fun challenge. And again, no regrets whatsoever about that. It was a fabulous experience for me. Lots of learning along the way as well. And one of my buzz phrases is always a scholar bee. Nobody knows everything. Here I am now, a new opportunity in Manchester, ironically back to where I started, but with a very different kind of radio station, a 24-hour speech format. People say speech can't be sustained commercially. Well, we're managing to do it, and we're doing that because we're doing it differently.
How would the young John Evington view the career that this John Evington has now behind him?
I think he'd be astounded. I can still remember those early days when I was working overnights at Piccadilly, and I'd get home and think to myself, this is a phase I'm going through. This is not a career, this is a phase, and I'll get it out of my system, and then I'll find a proper job and go through life like everybody else. Because, I mean, it was such a magical thing to be involved with. I couldn't really see it being a sustainable thing for me. I've done pretty much everything I ever wanted to do in terms of broadcasting. It was always an ambition to be on national radio. Well, I did that. Not for long, but I did it and quite enjoyed it.
433 and 330 metres medium wave, and of course, stereo VHF.
But I think the closer you are to your listener and your audience, the more rewarding it is. It's not about the size of audience, it's about that level of engagement. Yeah, on every level, I've enjoyed this career.